Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. The JOLTS report is out. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Newell. And here we are. It's football season, autumn. I guess I was caught sleeping all summer with the time moving on so quickly. I hope you're doing well.
I am, and I'm very excited about the football season started. I need some time to be, you know, to be manipulated by something other than what I've been doing all summer long. So it works for me. So, what does this report reveal?
Well, Noah, let me fast forward a little bit because the JOLTS report was released earlier in the week, and that gives us a view of the number of job openings. And then this morning we had the monthly employment report, which tends to be a little more consequential, but I think overarching theme is largely the same, and my analysis and headlines on both are remarkably similar. So at least I win a point for consistency this week. I'll leave it to others about the accuracy, but so the job openings number told us the job openings declined to nearly 7.2 million in July. That's the lowest in 10 months, and two drivers of employment in recent months saw the biggest declines, and those are healthcare and social assistance. And so whether you look at the job openings report, which, by the way, shows us that the number of job openings has fallen below the total number of unemployed for the first time in quite some time, or the monthly employment report that we had this morning, where we only added 22,000 jobs in August, actually now know that we had a contraction in employment in June, and the nation's unemployment rate rising to 4.3%. My overall thesis has been that this is largely a no-hire, no-fire job market. It's the last part of that, which is to some degree the salvation, because that's keeping the unemployment rate at least so far at a relatively low 4.3%, but that doesn't give us any guarantees for the future.
So when we look at healthcare's, for couple of years now has been one of the leaders, right, in job growth. Is there any underlying conditions that are driving these numbers down now?
It's our collective aging condition in this country, among other things. We do have an aging population, and we've known for some time that healthcare comprises a massive one-fifth of the U.S. economy, with subpar outcomes relative to our peers. And so we pay more for less favorable outcomes for healthcare in this country, speaking to a high degree of inefficiency and high cost. There are some fabulous things about the healthcare sector in our country. It's very innovative. You can have a high quality of care as long as you can afford it. It's to bring the football analogy back around. If you're in the owner's suite, you're doing very well. If you're in the bleachers or knocking on the door from the outside, not so much. And so, we do have essentially the public commitment in the sense of Medicare and Medicaid, obviously the latter having been cut back recently by Congress, but those alone help to affirm a high degree of demand for health care. And then, of course, those of us that are fortunate enough to be working in the private sector have our employee benefit, which doesn't excuse us from having to pay out-of-pocket costs, but it helps to defray some of that.
But this translates into job loss. How? Because the demand is still up, right, for the services.
Well, we're not seeing job loss in healthcare per se, but rather with the JOLTS report, we saw fewer job openings. In the August employment report this morning, it was still a pillar of jobs creation as it has been in recent months. And in July, we had 55,000 jobs added in healthcare. In August, we had 31,000. But the point is that we have a lot of mouths to feed and employment sectors in this economy, and right now you're only feeding a few of those.
Number of folks are saying that we're beginning to feel the pain of tariffs. Your thoughts?
Well, if I just go back and look at the monthly jobs creation numbers here, Newell, in April, we added 158,000. We know the announcement at the White House came in early April with regard to tariffs. So 158,000 jobs added in April, and it's been downhill ever since. So May, we added just 19,000 jobs. June, we lost 13,000 jobs. A little bit of a bounce back in July, 79,000 jobs added. And as we said this morning, 22,000 jobs added in August. As we talk about sectors, Newell, I think one of the more painful realities of this situation is that the argument could be made for quite some time now that the manufacturing sector in this country has been in contraction mode. And when we look at the sector, the goods producing sectors, including manufacturing, have not been adding jobs in the U.S. economy. And so you can draw the correlations or the causes, you know, however you might see fit. But we're just not seeing it for manufacturing.
Are we in a transition period, Mark, relative to some of the major manufacturing sectors? So, for example, automobiles. Less automobiles being produced, less need for manufacturing employees because the EVs and the EV market with the incentives going away is just kind of almost fundamentally disappeared.
Well, first of all, and I'm speaking as someone who owns EVs and very much a fan of the technology and the lack of monthly maintenance costs that's associated with that. You know, we still have pretty strong fundamental underlying demand for automobiles in this country. I think that EV demand is going to sort of level out at a certain point, leaving aside what the federal government was doing to help to, if we use the word, juice those numbers previously because of the tax incentives. I can see it when I go across any of my road trips, as I did last weekend, and a bigger road trip, 1,100 miles between here and where I live in Washington, D.C., Canada, with the burgeoning number of charging stations. And that really is helping to address the number one concern that prospective and actual EV owners have, and that's range anxiety. Can I get the electricity charge that I need? So that's slowly but surely being addressed. And the reality is that for the owners, the economic incentive to own an EV is there without any help from Uncle Sam or anybody else. You don't have to pay the monthly maintenance costs in the form of oil changes, brake pad replacements, just so many things where the ongoing cost of an automobile is higher if it's an internal combustion engine. There are a lot of reasons to want to have an internal combustion engine, but the maintenance cost is not one of them. And so I think that that fundamental shift is going to continue, whether this president's in office or the former president is no longer.
Yeah, but I mean, every day I open up, you know, news stories where manufacturers are announcing, we're not making this EV car anymore. We're not making this EV truck anymore. We're not making this EV SUV anymore. And they're not replacing it with additional SUV models. So to me, that's emblematic of they're having a problem selling these vehicles and they're upside down. You know, and that is, if that's the case, those production facilities, they're laying people off. And you know, when it's a pretty big sector of jobs out there for us, at least in the manufacturing world. And that's why I asked whether or not you thought, I'm not talking about, you know, the utilization and the life cycle of the EV market, but at this point in time right now, do we see this reaction to what's happening September 30th? The incentives go away.
Yeah.
And do we see this? And we also, interestingly, I was reading a report the other day of how many EV vehicles are being turned in at the present time and to dealers when they buy new cars that are combustion engine cars, which is kind of interesting as well.
Well, first of all, somebody's going to buy those used vehicles. They aren't being obliterated. And so, if anything, that's an entry point at, let's say, $22,000 on an EV that previously cost $40,000. Those are selling as well. So those don't go away. But I think the point is that you know, there's absolutely has had to been a readjustment on the part of some of the manufacturers to align with ongoing demand. And, you know, there was sort of there was an incentive for the manufacturers and consumers to perhaps buy at levels that weren't sustainable previously. But I think all that will level out in time. And, you know, we're still an automobile reliant society, even with all the utilization of ride sharing. If you're in Los Angeles, you see the Waymo robotic cars happening. That's a quite mind-blowing phenomenon. There probably is a disincentive for people to buy cars in the future simply because among the pain points are the high ongoing costs of monthly insurance and, of course, registration and maintenance being at least part of the equation for most of the automobile owners out there. So I think if anything, and this is what Tesla believes, this is what Waymo believes, the people that are looking at this in the long term, is that there are going to be some disincentives for people to own automobiles, even though there are obviously many areas of the country, particularly rural and small towns across America, where those ride-sharing options just are largely irrelevant.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's going to be a challenge for that manufacturing sector for years to come. It's not going away, obviously, not by any stretch of the imagination. But I you know, when I was just looking at the as you pointed out, the observation you made, that's the what, that's the outcome. I'm looking to try and identify the why. Why are we having this experience? And I guess I could almost say it's kind of at an accelerated rate, right? Because we've not seen drops like this historically.
Well, if you're talking about the EV adoption issue alone.
No, I'm just talking about jobs, bringing this back to jobs, you know, manufacturing, coming back to the job numbers, something, you know, this is the outcome. And I'm trying to figure out why, like in the auto world, why are we seeing these reductions, you know?
Well, for one, we have something that hadn't happened in 100 years, and that is the highest average effective tariff rate in place. And, you know, if one were to look at, for example, the Institute for Supply Management monthly reports, particularly the manufacturing reading, or the Federal Reserve's Beige Book report that we had earlier this week, the impacts of tariffs are very real. We're talking about higher input costs, higher costs that they have to manage, and there is the diminished demand where, you know, if you're looking at a product coming in from India now with a tariff of 50%, that, for example, is a large supplier, among other things, of jewelry. You know, consumers aren't going to raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm all on board on paying those increased costs. So this tariffs issue can be what I think Federal Reserve officials are largely aligning in their view upon, and that is that it can be a one-time price adjustment. Why that's significant is that it doesn't necessarily ensure that we're going to have, let's say, the everlasting experience with inflation that feels like we've had since 2022, and that may be the excuse that Federal Reserve officials use to lower interest rates in mid-September. I think the problem is with sort of saying that it's a one-time price adjustment is we don't know if the administration is going to continue to move that bouncing ball up and down as it's the favored tool of the White House.
And then you have the added uncertainty of the court, of potential court action.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. We don't know if they're legal or not.
Right. You don't know what's going to ultimately come out of there either. As always, truly enjoy the conversation with Mark Hamrick. Thank you so much for your time and your insight, and have a great weekend.
You too, my friend. All the best. Thank you.